Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Greetings, greetings, fellow Whogazers, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Target novelizations in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. We are now a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. I thank you very much for your time. I know you have many, many choices when it comes to Doctor Who podcasts, as well as podcasts in general. And this episode is being released on Sunday, the 23rd of October, 2022. A very strange day to be dropping a Doctor Who episode, because today is the day we lose Jodie Whittaker as the 13th Doctor. It's also the day that we say goodbye to Chris Chibnall as showrunner. They have both been dominant figures in our Doctor Who-related lives for the last 4 years. I have mixed feelings about Chibnall, as I have expressed many times on this show before, as well as over on Trap One. My guest today is Daniel Knight. You've heard him before on our episode about Doctor Who and the Space War. Later on today, Daniel and I will segue into a conversation about the legacy of the Chibnall years and, of course, Jodie Whittaker. I just concluded my Doctor Who pilgrimage yesterday. Of course, you can follow along on Twitter at Doctor Who Pilgrimage. That's hashtag Dr. Who Pilgrimage. The other night, I reached the Legend of the Sea Devils, and once I finish watching Power of the Doctor later today, I will be done. I started the pilgrimage on October 26th, 2020, with An Unearthly Child and The Cave of Skulls. I did the classic series two parts a night, and I did the new series one episode a night, although not every night now that I'm transitioning back to work in the office, and I no longer had the free time that I had much earlier in the pandemic. But it's been a remarkable two-year journey, and I hope to share my more detailed thoughts about that over on Trap One in the not-too-distant future. The point is, I know you have a choice, and not everybody is going to have time to listen to a Doctor Who podcast. Today, with 90 minutes devoted later in the day to saying goodbye to Jodie and Chris, I thank you very much for listening, and I thank you for all your feedback and your support of tweets and emails. I love having you guys as my audience. I have many friends who've been on the show. I have made many friends who have been on the show, and I have made many friends who I hope will be on the show in the not-too-distant future. This has been a great experience for me, and while I have mixed feelings about Chibnall in general as a writer and showrunner, watching The Flux over the last week has gotten me reinvigorated for the show. And you know what else has gotten me reinvigorated for the show, for the Power of the Doctor finale in general? This trailer, which was released earlier today.
Everything is about to change.
There's this moment when you're sure you're about to die.
Is this death?
And then you're born.
Dover.
What's happened?
Change, my dear.
Time Lords have this little trick.
It's all the way of cheating death. Except it means I'm gonna change.
Well, here we go again.
Even if I change, it feels like dying.
That one's too young!
Oh no, that won't do at all!
Hello. I'm the Doctor.
You're completely different.
What do you think of my new face, by the way?
Could be useful on the planet Delphon when they communicate with their eyebrows.
This is the best thing ever.
Never did this when I was a man.
Any moment now, he's coming.
Who's coming?
The Doctor.
Ralph Hart!
Don't forget me.
Don't you forget me.
Run fast.
Do you have a plan?
Nice to meet you, Dad. Run for your life.
Be kind.
One day, I shall come back.
But times change. So must I.
Doctor, I let you go.
Beware of the forces that mass against you and their master.
Something's coming for me. Almost ending.
Doctor! Yeah. That is just a great trailer, and that's only the audio. If you have not seen the visuals yet, check it out. There are approximately 0 seconds of new footage from The Power of the Doctor itself, but there is an incredible montage of regeneration moments both coming and going from the first 58 years of the series. Actually, we're at 59 now. Check that, my goodness. They even managed to restore some of the footage of the post-regeneration moments as Patrick Troughton wakes up in The Power of the Daleks, an episode that is very similarly named to tonight's episode. When you match the audio to the visual, it is even better, and it's gotten me very, very, very excited for tonight's upcoming episode. We have a lot to talk about today. Our book of the week is Doctor Who and the Robots of Death, in publication order, the 48th Target novelization. Coming up in 2 weeks, episode 50, Doctor Who and the War Games. I have started to receive your submissions. You can send me messages to read out. You can record a message yourself. I am very excited to hear what you guys have to say about Doctor Who and the War Games, and I will include your pieces in the finished episode. So keep getting those to me. We have about 2 weeks to go. In the meantime, get your buckets ready. We are going to be crying buckets later today with The Power of the Doctor. I am now positively sure of it. Now, last week on episode 47, you heard Cy Hart and myself talking about Doctor Who and the Invisible Enemy. That was recorded just after Cy went to the Terence Dix celebration at Riverside in London. And Cy has been very good so as to send us a correspondence piece. So for the next few minutes, I am once again turning the show back over to Cy, and he is going to talk to us about Terence Dix. After that, a couple of trailers for my friends and fellow podcasters on the Direction Point Podcast Network. Then my conversation with Daniel Knight. It's a good one. We talk a lot about The Robots of Death, the book, The Robots of Death on TV, the Jodie and Chibnall era, and of course the Philip Hinchcliffe era, to which we sadly say goodbye. This is the final Robots of Death novelization of a Philip Hinchcliffe era story, and it is just leaving us way, way too soon. At the end of the program, my review of Doctor Who and the Robots of Death, the novelization, and then of course trailers for next week, episode 49. Let's get to it.
So one of the things I've done recently was I was lucky enough to go to the Terence Dix tribute convention, which was a celebration of him and his work. And I think mostly for your listeners, Jason, one of the things that I know has been pulled out quite often about Terence Dix's work through the podcast has been how difficult it is to write in a simple way. Rather than sort of writing sort of over the top and very florid, very descriptive, very wordy novels, the thing that was celebrated about him more on that day than anything else was his absolute skill and precision in writing these novelizations. And hearing it on stage from people like Stephen Moffat and Paul Cornell and Nigel Robinson and Peter Darvill Evans, people who he wrote for, sort of saying that they look back now and say what they dismissed as suddenly Stephen Moffat and Paul Cornell said what they dismissed as fans when they were younger, sort of saying that, oh, it's a Terence Dix novelization. We want more. We want a Malcolm Hulk. We want an Ian Marta epic expanded thing. But actually, Stephen Moffat made the point very much that what Terence does is deliver what is on the screen to you. And that's a real skill. And what a lot of fans absolutely dismissed sort of over time, but actually those were the ones, like I've said, I think as well, those were the ones as a child that you absolutely devoured. So hearing Dan Starkey talking about how much he loved and absolutely adored the Nightmare of Eden novelization, and that was his favorite. And he was so pleased that he got to do the talking book version of that, because that was a book that he'd loved as a child. And he hadn't even seen it on TV, but he knew the characters. He cast all the characters with actors that he knew, and sort of speaking about that. And then Katie Manning talking about how sort of reading the books aloud for the audiobooks, how Terence's prose was just so easy to read aloud because it wasn't difficult. He, someone joked that Terence Dix knew more than anyone else the power of a full stop and a short sentence. And you haven't got huge run-on sentences. He just writes, and writes technically brilliantly. And so it reads beautifully, which sort of when you're having it read aloud, as I was as a child, and then having it read aloud sort of in the audiobooks later on, is really important. But what really came across was that no one who'd worked with him had a bad word to say about him. That he, although he was slightly grumpy and slightly unapproachable and wouldn't take praise very well, secretly, and his family confirmed this secretly, he absolutely loved it. And he loved being remembered as a man who made a generation of children, particularly young boys, read. And his favourite story to tell was, says, well, of course, you start with Terence Dix and you move up to Charles Dickens. And what do you do? Where do you go for that? That's absolutely perfect. And that's exactly what I did. I started with Terence Dix. His books made me want to read as a child and learn to read so that I could read them on my own. And from there, that started my lifelong love of reading, really. So, I mean, yeah, it was a beautiful day and a wonderful tribute to him. And seeing his sons come up on stage at the end of the day and talk about how much they love their dad, but also just hearing from them how much they loved hearing how much everyone else loved their dads. That was, yeah, really amazing. They all say, who
is Doctor Who? Do you collect Doctor Who? Do you have Doctor Who items and you don't know that you collect Doctor Who? For all things in the Doctor Who collecting world, tune in to the Doctor Who Collectors Podcast, a Direction Point Network podcast. I am Larry Van Mersbergen, your host, and I have been collecting Doctor Who for 41 years. We have popular features like collection protection and the most outrageous offer anywhere you get your podcasts. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
You are invited on an adventure across all of time and space in a completely random order. It's the Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. Jump in the TARDIS with your hosts,
Eric Gulbranson,
Asad Keshki,
and
Matthew Kressel.
Explore Doctor Who TV stories, audio adventures, and books, both novels and non-fiction. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. It's the entire Whoniverse on Shuffle. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast is a member of the Direction Point Network and is available about once a month wherever you find your podcasts. You are listening to the Doctor Who Literature podcast.
So, Daniel, welcome back. This is your second time on Doctor Who Literature. I think the last time you were here, we talked about Doctor Who and the Space War, a.k.a. Frontier in Space.
Mm-hmm. That's right, we did. It was, good book. Not possibly one of Malcolm Hulk's best, but, a very enjoyable read. Quite a bit more substantial than the one we're going to be looking at today.
I was going to say, I mean, maybe Space War is not Malcolm Hulk's best book, but only because its previous standards were so high. Whereas today, we are in publication order. This is the 48th book put out by Target. That includes the reprints of the three Frederick Mullers. This is the shortest of the first 48. This is Doctor Who and the Robots of Death. I am holding up my third edition copy from 1982. This book clocks in at 102 pages, considering that it starts on page 7 and ends on page 108.
Yes, it's what some people would call Terence's lean period. But it's not a bad book. I got this in about 1982, so I would have been about 9. So I would have been about the right age for this book. Possibly, if you'd been collecting the books since the start, if you'd been, say, for example, 9 years old in 1973, by the time this came out in 1979, you'd be 15 and wanting something a little bit more substantial, I think. And you'd probably would have remembered the older books as well. We would have been collecting them, and so you'd have seen sort of slight decrease in the word count and the complexity of Terence's work, and it sort of.
I think with Terence, it's not fair just to talk about the page count, because as you pointed out in a Twitter thread earlier this week, this is actually a smaller print or smaller typeface than the previous book, last week's The Invisible Enemy, which Cy Hart and I pretty much savaged. Yes. That was a longer book by page count. That clocked in at 104 pages to Robots' 102, but Invisible Enemy was a larger typeface. So those who know the word count for each target novelization, this one probably is larger by word count than Invisible Enemy.
And I think looking at the introductory paragraph on page 7, it sets the scene very well. I don't know. Shall I read it for us?
Go ahead.
Okay. Like a city on the move, the sand miner glided across the desert sands. Not quite a city, a mobile factory perhaps. There were storage holds, control rooms, laboratories, living quarters, food stocks, a recycling plant. The sand miner was completely self-contained, able to range the deserts for years at a time before returning to base. Powered by its mighty hovercraft mechanisms, the sand miner glided over the fine shifting sands, a massive metal crab on an immense multicoloured sea of sand. It was about to become a ship of death. Now, it's very short, but that really sort of catches the imagination. Certainly it would catch the imagination of a 9-year-old. I don't have the copy to hand, but there's sort of like a similar introductory passage to the Invisible Enemy, and it talks about a shapeless creature entity in space, floating around in space, which doesn't really sort of capture the imagination. It's sort of a bit of a shapeless introduction, really, whereas this is very, you know, very to the point. It sets the scene, sets the idea of what the sand mine is about, what's on there. I don't think it's a bad book for what it is. It's certainly not his best work, but it does the job quite easily.
I think the next paragraph after the passage that you read is also pretty evocative. This is the second section of the book, still on page 7, where he's talking about the inhabitants of the sand miner. Inside the sand miner, robots were everywhere. They stalked silently through the long metal corridors on mysterious errands. They labored in the engine rooms and the storage hoppers. They worked on the vast, complex control deck. And then after that, there's a pretty long passage, bottom of page 7, top of page 8, where Terence describes what kind of robots you find on the sand miner. So, again, setting aside the page count, which is the smallest to date, I think Terence adds a lot more value to this story than he added to Invisible Enemy. As Cy and I mentioned last week, with Invisible Enemy, you got the sense that he hated the story, hated the script, thought it was ludicrous, and was just saying, fine, I'm going to type this up, but I'm not going to enjoy it, and I'm not going to give it anything extra. I think throughout Robots of Death, and I'll talk about this a little more in the back half of the program when I do my review, I think he adds a lot more value to the TV story, possibly because he liked the TV story a lot better. I think Robots of Death is a much higher order of magnitude of quality than Invisible Enemy, because Invisible Enemy was the first story of the Graham Williams era, when the production team was kind of finding its new footing, whereas this is the height of the Philip Hinchcliffe years, and this is the unfortunately last novelization of a Philip Hinchcliffe era story. So it's going out pretty strong, I think.
Yeah. The whodunit element, I would imagine, would have been quite a strong draw to Terrence as well, because I think he liked his sort of, you know, crime fiction. I know, I think he mentioned in one interview he liked Raymond Chandler, may have been sort of also liked Agatha Christie, which is very much this is, you know, the Ten Little Indians or and then there were none sort of scenario of a small group of people being bumped off one by one. And the characters are quite well delineated, aren't they? I mean, there's it's quite strong descriptions of the characters and what they look like. And in the first, there's the character Chubb, who seems to be quite mischievous, sly, round-faced, he's described as. And there's another point where he's sort of trying to, Chubb looked resentfully at Dask, he was spoiling the joke. So there's a lot more going on here than in that first scene in The Invisible Enemy, sort of character-wise. It's quite a nice sort of establishing scene where you get to know all the different characters and the likes and dislikes of each other.
That's a good point as well, because in The Invisible Enemy, most of the characters are ciphers. A lot of them aren't even given proper names. There are characters called ophthalmologist and medic and nurse. So there's not a whole lot of there. The only really proper guest stars are Professor Marius and K-9, the latter of whom becomes a companion. Robots of Death, I think, is much more to Terrence's liking. And you make a really interesting point. We don't talk a lot about Terrence's roots, but even though Terrence was from a much older generation than us, even his generation had its own pop culture touchstones and interests. When you're reading the New Adventures in the 1990s, most of the authors in the New Adventures are British fans in their mid to late 20s. And when you read their books, they're very much in tune with the pop culture obsessions that you would get from somebody born between 1960 and 1970. It's evident when you read Russell T. Davis's book, which has a tour guide to New York City. It's evident when you read a Gary Russell book. Gary Russell's first novel, Legacy, every chapter title is named for a Gary Numan song. And when you read a Paul Cornell book, he talks a lot about his favorite cricket players or whatever other pop culture obsession he would have had that week.
Yeah.
So when you're reading a Doctor Who book from the 1990s, you're tapping into a particular cultural zeitgeist. When you're reading Terrence, you're also tapping into his cultural zeitgeist. It's just that his cultural zeitgeist is 40 years before everybody else in the New Adventures range. So he was a big fan of mysteries and gangsters. So one of his more interesting post-novelization books is Blood Harvest, which when you rank all the New Adventures in quality from 1 to 61, Blood Harvest is probably in the 40s, maybe the 30s, okay, but more likely in the 40s. However, it is Terrence telling a story that he wants to tell because it takes place in Prohibition-era Chicago. It's got a lot of real-life historical figures that he brings in. And it's very much, not even openly, it's just basically a direct lift from Raymond Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrence, of course, had previously done Horror of Fang Rock, which is Agatha Christie in a lighthouse with Rutans.
Yes.
And also a vampire story with Rutans. And vampires also show up in Terrence's own Blood Harvest. So those were the things that he liked the most. Implacable killers picking you off one by one. Robots of Death is the robots of death and not the vampires of death. But other than that, it's right in Terrence's wheelhouse as an author, whereas Invisible Enemy, I don't think had nearly as much to keep him entertained when he was sitting in his room typing away on the typewriter.
Well, maybe he would have seen Fantastic Voyage that Invisible Enemy is slightly based on. I don't know. But Robot as well, his script for that, that's very much sort of based on King Kong, the idea of the heroine falling or feeling sympathy for the giant robot or gorilla, depending on which one you're watching. It's very much that they're very similar, aren't they? And that probably would have been, I don't think he would have been about when the film was released back in the early 1930s, but I'm sure it would have been sort of shown in cinemas. It would have been one of those probably Saturday morning films that people of his generation would have seen.
And in the same regard, his next TV episode after Robot is Brain of Morbius. And if Robot is an homage to King Kong, Brain of Morbius is basically Frankenstein. And yes, Brand of Morbius got heavily rewritten by Robert Holmes, and Terrence took his name off the script, although later took it back. I heard that later in life, his email address had the phrase Robin Bland in it. But yeah, this is a guy whose first two Tom Baker scripts were King Kong and Frankenstein, and Horror of Fang Rock was supposed to be Dracula, because he had submitted originally vampire script, which the BBC nixed. So instead, he turned Horror of Fang Rock into Vampires in a Lighthouse. There's a character named Harker that's called Fang Rock, and the people are stalked off one by one. So those are his first three Doctor Who stories. You have King Kong, Frankenstein, Dracula.
Yeah.
And here you have a Raymond Chandler murder mystery with robots.
With robots. Yeah. One of the things about the book, though, is that I'm also quite a fan of the original episodes, and it was one of the first stories to be released on video. So when I'm reading the book, and certainly when I've been reading the book to look at it for this, I can hear the dialogue in my head. Even when Terrence slightly changes it, it sort of sticks out that you know, maybe another character that says something that in the book that it would have been said by someone else in the TV series. There's one in particular, I think it's at the start of chapter 13, when they're talking about Paul, you know, about being you know, how did they know Paul, that the line, how did you know Paul wasn't what he pretended to be, is actually asked by Toose in the novelization, but it's actually Leela who asks him the question, and that's why she realized, she asked him about body language, and she says the slight sort of differences in the script in the novel compared to the script, but I've still got the dialogue in my head regardless of who says it, because I watched that when I was a teenager in the early late 1980s when it came out on video, so it's fairly burned in my memory from watching it so many times.
The first time that I would have seen Robots of Death would have been because they started showing Tom Baker in sequence on my local PBS station on Long Island in February 1985 when I was 11. And it took them about 9 months to get through the entirety of Tom Baker. I think Legopolis aired the last week of 1985, and therein hangs a tale about how I missed seeing part four of Legopolis for a very long time due to a VCR malfunction. That is going to be a story that I'll save for another day, because I have Legopolis coming up probably in about 6 months on this program. That's a story I very much look forward to telling. So Robots of Death probably would have aired in May or June 85, and I would have watched it over 4 nights. And it's a story that very much captures the imagination, because it is some of the best design work of the Hinchcliffe era. You have the Art Deco interiors of the sand miner. You have these incredibly creepy robot masks. And this is a new cover artist for the Target novelizations. We've moved on from the Roy Knipe era.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just holding up. That's a really good likeness of the TV mask, especially with the glowing red eyes on the cover after the robots have been turned by Taron Capel.
Slightly the wrong color, though, and I don't think in the book Terrence differentiates between the different robots. I think they're all silver, whereas, of course, we know in the TV series the dumb robots are black. The Vok robots are green rather than the sort of slightly goldy yellow on the cover. And you've also got the Super Vok SV7, which is sort of gold, silver and gold.
Other interesting points, Tom Baker's scarf is the wrong set of colors on the novelization cover. This looks more like, I don't know if you have them in the UK, but we call them a packet of lifesavers here in the US. Those are lifesaver colors, lemon, mint, orange, cherry.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Baker's scarf was much more off-color than that. And also, yes. Tom Baker's curly hair takes up by volume about 45% of this cover. That is a lot of Tom Baker hair.
He looks slightly jaundiced as well. Mine's probably a little bit more faded than yours, but he looks the color of his skin looks a bit sort of. I don't think Tom's really that color. Looks a little bit ill personally, but I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that because the illustrator is John Geary, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and that his covers weren't quite in the same league as some of the other artists. I mean, it's certainly stuck out to me when I saw this in the shop and wanted to buy it. But the green sort of slightly, the green, yeah, you could have had maybe a bit more of a sticking with the Art Deco design. Having just a blank green background is a bit boring. So it doesn't really give an idea of what the story looks like, other than the Doctor, who we all know what he looks like, and the robot. But yeah, I think it was his first cover, was it?
It was. I mean, we've kind of been spoiled for choice. We're going in publication order. This is book 48. Prior to this, the covers were by Christos Achilleos.
Mm.
You have Jeff Cummins.
Mm.
You have Roy Knipe, who did the several covers before this one, such as Santarin Experiment and Invisible Enemy. And some of those covers just blow you away with their quality. And then you have the Mike Little covers, which were replaced and didn't come out in the States in the 1980s, but those covers were more comic book style, such as the original cover for Terror of the Autons or Planet of the Spiders, which has the regeneration photos and sequence,
mm-hmm.
and the original robot. So this is perhaps not the best of the Target covers that we've seen in sequence. And yeah, I don't know if I'd say Tom Baker looks jaundiced, because our covers are slightly different colors, but you have the green background on the gold robot. It does sort of wash out the other colors, and it sort of spoils Tom Baker's complexion by association, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a good likeness, but and obviously from the picture that it's with him holding the Lasersim probe, but yeah, it's not the best cover. I think the best artist to capture Tom is Jeff Cummings. His covers are, you know, the Horror of Fang Rock and Face of Evil in particular, so good likenesses. And also it's a good likeness of Louise Jameson on the front cover of the Face of Evil too.
Yes, and I'll also give my props to Roy Knipe, who had very good likenesses of Tom Baker on Santarin. My cat seems to be on a one feline mission to knock everything off the surface of the table. Maybe I'm not paying her enough attention. But I was going to say, the Roy Knipe covers for Santarin Experiment and Invisible Enemy, not to mention Hand of Fear, are also excellent likenesses of Tom Baker and, of course, Liz Sladen in the middle of that. So we've talked about the cover of the book. I think I like it a little more than you do. I'll agree that he's not the best of the cover artists, but still pretty solid work in its own right.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, we've talked about the text of the book. I want to talk more about the book, and I want to talk more about Robots of Death on TV, but at the same time, I also want to talk about some breaking news in the world of Doctor Who this week. This episode is going to be coming out on the same day that The Power of the Doctor airs. So this is the final Jodie Whittaker story. It's the final Chris Chibnall story. Now, Daniel, you and I think, were together on the Trap One at the very beginning of this year for the Eve of the Daleks New Year's Day special.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I think I enjoyed it more than you did.
What I will say is that I'm at the very end of the Doctor Who pilgrimage on Twitter. I have two stories to go. Mm-hmm. I just watched Eve of the Daleks again last night. Now, Flux, I had loved parts 1 through 3 of Flux the first time. I was a little less enthused with parts 4 through 6 of the Flux the first time. When I watched Flux 5 and 6 again earlier this week, I suddenly, especially with part 6, had greater fondness for them than I did originally, because I picked up things that I missed the first time, picked up bits of exposition, picked up bits of backstory, and all of a sudden I came to appreciate what a tremendous achievement it is for Chibnall to have all these different pieces in there, because you have about 20 or 25 speaking characters in every episode of The Flux, and they're all in groups of 2 or 3 because of pandemic filming restrictions.
Hmm.
I think the work that Chibnall does in tying everything together in part 6, even though I don't really love elements of the resolution of the story, I think it's titanic work for him to put all that together as coherently and as cogently as he did. So I am now a much bigger fan of the entire Flux season than I was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
The only episodes that really don't work for me are Village of the Angels and Survivors of the Flux, which really annoys me with the Grand Serpent going back in time and interfering with UNIT, and Lethbridge Stewart gets demoted from lieutenant to corporal and then goes back to colonel, which is an impossible career path.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really enjoyed Flux a lot more this time, so that brings us back to Eve, which I watched last night for the first time since we did our Trap One recording. The only problem that I have with Eve is that although each time loop is supposed to be shorter than the one before, loops 2, 3, and 4 get progressively longer, and it's noticeable with a stopwatch, and it's even noticeable on your own.
Mm-hmm.
If loops are getting shorter, the writing and the editing don't make it that way. So it goes from 6 minutes to 7 to 8 to 9 when it should be going in the reverse order. That being said, it's a very funny story. I mean, I really enjoy, because you have Aisling Bea is very funny as Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Jodie Whittaker is at her funniest. John Bishop's comic timing is impeccable. When they realize they're in a time loop, the Doctor goes time loop, Yaz goes time loop, and Dan goes Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
And the timing on that is impeccable. So I think I enjoyed Eve a lot when we talked about it on Trap One, although that was so long ago that I no longer recall what I said, but I really enjoyed it again last night. So
that's good.
I think the Chibnall era is actually improving as it goes. Now, I may change my mind. I'll be watching Legend of the Sea Devils tonight for the first time since I did the Trap One on that, and I don't expect that to hold up very well. We'll see how I feel this time.
Yeah.
But that brings us to Power of the Doctor. So this episode comes out the same day as the Chibnall era ends. So let me take your temperature on this. I want to hear from you first. What has been your take on the entirety of the Chibnall era so far?
Mm-hmm.
We've had about 4 full years worth of episodes going from late 2018 to now. And then I want to hear your predictions for what's going to happen in Power of the Doctor.
Oh, gosh. As a whole, I've enjoyed the Chibnall era a lot more than other people have.
Right.
And I keep seeing people on, you know, social media going, oh, Jodie's been okay, but she's been spoiled by the writing. I don't think the writing has been terrible. I don't think the writing has been universally good. There have been a few episodes that have sort of dipped a bit. But I have really enjoyed it, and I found certainly when it was announced that the Doctor number 13 was going to be a lady, I wasn't all that impressed. I didn't really want a female Doctor, but if Jodie Whittaker has managed to persuade a curmudgeonly old Doctor Who fan like me that a female Doctor can work, then I think she's been fantastic. I can't remember where I read it now, but somebody said that the thing that they most associate with Jodie's Doctor is joy. And I think that's one of the things that I've picked up on, is that she is so full of life. She's so full of energy, and she and on screen and also off screen in interviews, and she's absolutely having a ball. And I know that that the reason she's leaving and she's, she burst into tears when she was filming her last scene, and when they said, no, that's a wrap. And I'd love to meet her. I'd love to say, I think, how wonderful she is. I think the first two seasons the three companions didn't really work. Poor old Yaz, a lot of the time, it was a bit like season 19 with, the fifth Doctor, Tegan Adric and Nyssa. Yaz was very much like the Nyssa of the character, in that she would be often sort of in the background, or certainly didn't seem as prominent as either Graham or Ryan. But over the last year with Flux and Eve and Legend of the Sea Devils, It's been great to see Mandip Gill get so much more to do, and she's been brilliant. John Bishop has been fantastic as well. Really, not surprised. What I love about Dan's character is he's just so normal, and there's nothing. All the companions are just normal people. There's no gimmicks. They're not impossible girls. They're not, they are. They seem like genuinely nice people and believable people. I mean, certainly Bradley Walsh. I know some people were saying, well, what's Bradley Walsh doing in Doctor Who? But if you've seen him in the British version of Law and Order, he's fantastic. He's a fantastic actor. So I've really enjoyed it. There has been some episodes that I think have been fantastic. I like the three Dalek episodes. I think Chibnall's very good at writing the Daleks, whereas Stephen Moffat wasn't quite so. He tried to sort of do different angles, and it didn't really work for me. I think he's been very good with bringing the Sontarans back. I think the some of the characters, the guest characters that we've had, have been very good. Particularly Kevin McNally as Professor Jericho, and I know there was a huge uproar when his character part was killed off at the end of Flux. So yeah, I've enjoyed it. I think in comparison to the Moffat era, if I was to mark every episode of his and Chibnall's out of 10, probably the average would be about the same. However, with the highs in Moffat's era are a lot higher. And the lows in Moffat's era are a lot lower, whereas Chibnall is very much, I wouldn't say flatline, but because there have been some really good stories and some wonderful stories that I've enjoyed. But yeah, they're pretty much, I would say they'd average out pretty much the same.
That's a really good point. I'll echo your point about the highs of the Moffat era being a lot higher than the highs of the Chibnall era. I will say this. My biggest problems with the Jodie Whittaker era have nothing to do with Jodie herself. Having paid attention specifically to her performances over the last month, as I've been watching her stories back, I don't like a lot of Chibnall's dialogue, and I don't like a lot of the plots. I thought that Series 11 was lacking a lot of momentum, because there's really no big bad, apart from Tim Shaw, who I didn't really think was a very interesting villain. Series 12 I loved at the beginning, especially once we had the revelations of Fugitive of the Jadoon, but I thought that Ascension of the Cybermen / the Timeless Children was just overloaded, and I didn't like most of the storytelling choices, and I didn't like that Chibnall contorted the narrative just to retcon away a 45-second passage from the brain of Morbius. I wasn't crazy about that revelation. I have no real emotional investment in the idea of pre-Hartnell Doctors. However, even though I'm not crazy about Chibnall's individual stories, and while I think he's probably the second or third, if not the weakest writer of his own era, Jodie's performance is always amazing, and I love listening to the way that she delivers exposition. And that's the word that you use, joy. She adds a quality to her line readings which is not matched by anybody else around her. She's always the most interesting character in the room. She changes her pitch of voice, and she changes her tone and her mood several times in the middle of a single sentence or paragraph, which only Tom Baker had really done before that. That being said, the way Chibnall writes for her, especially in Series 12 and Series 13, he unfortunately writes her as a very, very passive character. So in Timeless Children, she is standing around while somebody else explains the plot to her. In Revolution of the Daleks, she's sitting in a prison asteroid for literally decades, and then a male needs to show up and break her out within 45 seconds. That's the Captain Jack character. And then in episode 5 of The Flux, which is the first or second weakest Flux episode, depending on how you feel, of Village of the Angels, she spends literally the entire episode standing in a room surrounded by Christmas lights, having another character deliver exposition at her. Mm-hmm. The Osok character, whose name changes to Tektayun halfway through the episode. I don't think Chibnall used her doctor very well, but I think she acted the part very well, and I really hope that she gets a lot more to do in the finale. Now, there's a lot going on in Power of the Doctor. You're going to have multiple returning companions. You're going to have the Master. There are going to be other spoilers and surprises that we don't even know about yet 48 hours before the event. I'm worried that there's not going to be a lot of room for the Doctor in that, because you're going to have so many returning characters and plot threads to accommodate. If it's anything like The Vanquishers, which is the last episode of Flux, there's going to be a lot of story crammed into the running time. And I'm sure he'll do a great job of stitching everything together,
but I'm afraid it's not going to leave a lot of room for the Doctor to be the Doctor, and I'm afraid it's not going to leave a lot of room for Jodie Whittaker to have good character moments for the Doctor. Acting moments, yes, but I'm afraid the character is unfortunately not going to get a lot to do. We'll see how that shakes out, of course. We're still 48 hours out, and we literally have no idea what to expect because the production team has given us nothing. We have no idea what's coming.
No, I mean, you said about, you know, returning characters. We know for sure that Janet Fielding and Sophie Aldred are coming back as Tegan and Ace, but there are rumours that it's not just them. And there was something in the press recently about Bonnie Langford coming back. But again, somebody said that possibly is just coinciding with, the journalist has got it wrong, and it's to do with the Russell T Davis Big Finish audio that she did recently.
Yeah, Ross was here on a couple of weeks ago talking about a different story, and he mentioned that as well, that the Bonnie Langford revelation might have to do with Mind of the Hodiak. Mm. That's back in episode, I think, 46 or 47.
That might be where I heard it from, yeah. But, you know, you've got the Daleks, you've got the Cybermen, you've got the Master coming back, there's UNIT involved. The plot involves, you know, volcanoes and seismologists being kidnapped or disappearing. And there's in the trailer, there's a picture of Ace standing it's possibly the National Gallery or the National Portrait Gallery, looking at an empty wall, possibly avoiding people throwing tins of soup over, you know, Van Gogh paintings.
Yes, but, to bring a topical reference into the conversation.
Yes. We know so little, and apart from the fact that in the trailer, I do love the scene where you see Tegan and Ace firing at what looks like to be the Cybermen, and Tegan's got sort of like that. She's sort of, you know, really giving it, and then I don't know if it's done deliberately, but Sophie Aldred with the gun, she just looks so cool. Janet Fielding's like really giving it her all, and just, yeah, and I don't know if that's deliberate. I hope it's deliberate, and it looks both of them looks both in character, you know, that Tegan would be really giving it all, and Ace is like, yeah, I can do this, I'm cool. I've been against Cybermen before. I mean, they've both shot Cybermen before, haven't they? Both Tegan and Ace have shot Cybermen before. So this is, I know one of the other returning characters is Kate Stewart, and I hope, and I know I'm not alone, because Lucy McCall, part of the Ham family, is worried that they're going to kill off Kate, and I hope they don't kill her off either. So there's got to be somebody to be killed off. Rumoured possibly that it might be Dan. I don't know, because the idea is that he's only, or the rumour is that he's only at the beginning, and I don't know. I don't hope they don't kill off Dan either. Yeah,
it would be kind of churlish to kill off a major character other than the Doctor in the last episode, especially for an ongoing story. Some of these characters go back to different showrunners. I don't want to see Tegan get killed off. I don't want to see Ace get killed off.
No.
I don't have too much interest in the Kate Stewart character for reasons that I don't need to get into here. However, it would be churlish to kill her off after several years on the show when she's not your character to begin with.
Well, she was actually. She was, because she was from the first scene in The Power of Three, wasn't she? And that was Chris Chibnall's story.
I figured her as a Moffat character, but you are correct. Chibnall created her. All right, well, I'll amend myself. In fact, I'm going to amend myself twice. First, I'll say, fine, if he wants to kill off his own character, go ahead. And second, I'll say that Ross and I did talk on this show for episode 44, The Android Invasion, but we talked about the Bonnie Langford rumors, not here, but over on Trap 1. It was a four-person panel breaking down the belated Power of the Doctor trailer. It was me and Mark and Jan and Ross, all of whom are Doctor Who literature veterans. And it was on that Trap 1 episode where Ross was talking about Bonnie Langford's return might have been owing to Mind of the Hodiak rather than coming back for Power of the Doctor. Mm-hmm. So I will say that.
Yeah. Somebody asked Nicola Bryant this week if she was back, and she said, no, not this time. So does that mean she's back again some other time? We don't know.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because today I received my season 22 US version Blu-ray in the mail, still on its original shrink wrap, and she is back in this, having recorded the new trailer.
Yeah. And she looked, and that was really good as well. Those trailers are really, really lovely put together. Lovely, you know, particularly that one, and also the recent one with Maureen O'Brien.
That was incredible. Yes, yes.
And the one for season 24 with Bonnie Langford's 24 Karat Gold, getting in all the other characters, you know, Edward Peel and is it Catherine Cusack? I can't remember the name, the lady, the actress who played the Blue Kang.
And, of course, Sylvester McCoy at the very end of that trailer. I mean, if you're going to do an episode where all the companions come back, one of the other rumors is that Bradley Walsh's character is going to be hosting a Zoom for all the Doctor's surviving companions across all the eras. Right. Not sure if that's true. I've only heard it as a rumor on other podcasts. I hope it's not true, because I think having a 10-minute sappy Zoom conversation would kind of defeat the drama of the episode. Yes. That being said, if anybody is going to write a reunion episode, Pete McTighe, who does these trailers, is the guy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
More so than Chibnall, I would think.
Possibly. I mean, probably everybody, by the time this is released on Sunday, everyone will be watching The Power of the Doctor rather than listening to us, and then they'll come back and go, well, you got that wrong, didn't you?
I'm going to have to release this episode much earlier in the day than I typically do, because otherwise nobody's going to listen to it at all. Like, for example, last week's episode with Cy had one of my best first day numbers ever. And if this drops on the same day as the Chibnall finale, I might get zero listeners. So I'll have to release this much earlier in the day so that folks can actually hear it.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I am guardedly optimistic. Having gotten a new perspective on Flux and having something of a newfound respect, maybe if not for Chibnall's writing, I have a newfound respect for his storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he'll give us a lot of spectacle. It might not hold up. I might not enjoy some of the revelations, but I think he's going to give us a good show. And I hear it's going to be 90 minutes long, which is a lot longer than The Vanquishers. So hopefully it is... You know, hopefully it is this generation's equivalent of the Five Doctors.
That would be good. Yeah. I always thought that the Vanquishers could have done with a little bit more time. And it's a shame that the BBC couldn't have just maybe given it a bit of a longer slot just to give it that extra sort of 5-10 minutes or so to breathe. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be the longest episode of Doctor Who since the Five Doctors. Because Day of the Doctor was only 75 minutes, wasn't it? And I think, was it... Journey's End and Voyage of the Damned were only about 70 minutes as well. So to get a 90-minute slot, there's going to be a lot to pack in. And who knows?
90 minutes is the length of a horror movie in the 1980s. If you look at your 1980s horror films, most of those are about 90 minutes in length. So you're getting a feature film, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. Or the equivalent to an Inspector Morse or, you know, 2-hour drama on ITV over here, if you take out all the adverts.
Or an episode of Sherlock from Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, which were also about 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so we've got about 20 minutes left. Let's take the next 10 minutes or so. He has been on this show twice before, and I've already recorded his third and final appearance for an upcoming episode. I want to talk about the legacy of Philip Hinchcliffe, though, because we've been talking about Chris Chibnall, who has a mixed legacy as showrunner. This is the last of the 16 novelizations of Philip Hinchcliffe-era stories. His first televised story was Ark in Space. His last televised story was Talons of Wang Chiang. Of the 16, this is the last book. I, of course, am biased because I've spoken to him several times, and I think he's just the nicest possible guy. I've been very generous with his time on this program. I have said critical things about some of his episodes on this show because I am here to be honest. I went into nauseating detail about my problems with the Android Invasion, although I did give him a soundbite to defend the story. And I have, obviously, problems with some of the stereotypes and talents of Wang Chiang. We have spent three episodes of this show talking about talents of Wang Chiang. We talked about it for the Talents book.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it when Graham Burke was on talking about a different book. And then we talked about it when Dale Smith, who literally wrote the book on talents, was here talking about The Hand of Fear. This is not going to be my fourth Talons episode, but I don't love all of Hinchcliffe's stories on the same level. I think some are better than others, and you would get in any era. There's always going to be good stories and bad stories.
Yeah.
That being said, he probably has the highest hit percentage, right up there with Barry Letts, probably a little higher than Barry Letts, I mean, probably right up there with Verity Lambert. If you look at all their stories, he's one of the ones who have the best percentage of all-time classics per total stories done. Robots of Death, for me, is just a middling episode in terms of Hinchcliffe. There are stories that I'd watch much more quickly if I was given a choice, but Robots of Death is one of the top 22 of all time in the last DWM poll. So for you, where do you rank the Hinchcliffe era? What do you think are some of the best parts? What do you think are some of the best episodes?
It was interesting you mentioned the Android Invasion, because that, along with possibly Revenge of the Cybermen, is probably the weakest of all his productions. But there's still quite a lot in there to enjoy. And I think if those are your weakest episodes, just shows how good your era of Doctor Who is. And it is my comfort era of Doctor Who. Yes, Talons of Wang Chiang, which I always associate getting it as a Christmas present, and so it's, I always feel like it's something I should be watching at Christmas, particularly with sort of the Victorian era, which the BBC can do so well. I mean, if you watch it in order, there's certainly a growing confidence in the production, and looking at how they can stretch the format and move it away from being a slightly safe children's TV show to being quite dark in some places. You move away from the aliens, and you get the singular alien or villain. So you get Sutek rather than a race of Osirians. You get the crinoids only come in twos, or one at a time. You know, there's only one on screen at the time, so they realize the show's limitations, both Hinchcliffe and Robert Holmes. So they make, rather than having a race of aliens like Silurians, and I think Robert Holmes started this with the Sontarans in The Time Warrior, you haven't got a big budget, so you can't get a whole race of aliens. So the stories like Genesis of the Daleks and Revenge of the Cybermen, good though they are, they're kind of shelved, and also Terror of the Zygons as well. Again, there's a limitation where the Doctor says, you know, you're going to take over the world. Isn't it a bit large for just about six of you? so you have to focus on singular villains rather than races of aliens. So you've got Sutek, which I think is probably one of the best, strongest villains of all time. Morbius as well. You've got Castro. You've got Eldrad in the Hand of Fear.
Eldrad must live.
Eldrad must live, and then of course I've shot myself in the foot, because then you get Robots of Death and you get a whole load of race of robots. But even so, the villain is one person, and the robots are so well designed in this show, in this story. They're so well done, and the appearance, the masks, the voice. Okay, the feet don't quite work well, and I was watching the documentary last night, Michael E. Bryant, the director, said, sort of admitted that he hadn't really told the costume designer that he was going to sort of, you know, shoot the feet. So, and had she known that he was going to do that, she would have made it a little bit more. The design would have not quite so basic, and not use the tinfoil around the edges of the feet. But it's a very strong story in a whole three seasons of strong stories, which interestingly at the time, I seem to remember that the Doctor Who Appreciation Society didn't like season 14 at all. I know the head of the Appreciation Society really laid into The Deadly Assassin, but other stories, including Robots of Death, were I think one was sort of described as being a little bit flat and a bit of a one. I think Mask of Mandragora was a bit of a muddle or something. I was trying to look for it to if we needed to talk about it. But yeah, they at the time the stories weren't very well received, and of course now, 40 odd years later, they are often in the top half of, you know, surveys and polls among Doctor Who fandom.
So let's talk about that year 2014 DWM survey. I have the results up on screen now. They counted multi-part stories from the new series as a single story. So, for example, Daleks of the Manhattan / Evolution of the Daleks is ranked 208, treated as a single story out of 241. But let's talk about the numbers. At the time this was done, I think it was after Day of the Doctor, and Day of the Doctor clocks in at number one on the survey. I would have it as a lot lower. 241 stories between Unearthly Child and Day of the Doctor, 1963 to 2013. It's the first 50 years of the show. Number 241 is The Twin Dilemma. Number 240 is Fear Her. 239 is Time on the Ranny. 238 is Time Lash. 237 is Time Flight. What do we learn from this? If the word time is in your story, it's one of the worst stories ever made, because three of the bottom five have the word time in the title.
Yeah.
And also, those are contentious choices for some of the absolute worst stories of all time. Sixth from the bottom, by the way, is Underworld, which is coming up on this show in about 6 weeks. Fraser Gregory is going to be here. I usually don't spoil in advance who my guests are, but Fraser is so excited for that episode. He's been talking about it quite a bit on Twitter, so I'm very happy to trail him. And Fraser, I also want to point out to you, my friend Fraser, The Dominators is number 234. So The Dominators is one of the 10 worst Doctor Who stories of all time, and you can defend it all you want, but the numbers don't lie, buddy. Where was I?
Doctor Who fans, what do they know?
Oh, I'm sorry, my evil twin took over the microphone for a moment. Now let's take a look at the top end of that survey. Number three, Genesis of the Daleks, that's Hinchcliffe. Mm-hmm. Number five, City of Death, that's Graham Williams, but it deserves to be there. Number six, Talons, Hinchcliffe. Number eight, Pyramids of Mars, Hinchcliffe. Number 11, Robots of Death, this week's episode. 11th greatest Doctor Who story of all time in the first 50 years. 14, Terror of the Zygons. 20, Seeds of Doom. 21, The Deadly Assassin. Sorry about that, Jan Vincent Rutsky. 22, The Ark in Space. So 8 of the top 22 are Hinchcliffe, and he only did 16.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about a little bit further down the list, Brain of Morbius is number 41. One of the 50 greatest Doctor Who stories of all time is another Hinchcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
Scrolling down and working my way up from the bottom, the absolute lowest ranked Hinchcliffe story of all time is number 146, The Android Invasion. We've talked about it on this show. I don't think it's very good. Philip talked about it with me during a different interview, so I cut out about 90 seconds of that, and I put it in the Android's Invasion episode. It's him talking about the Android Invasion. He defends it, but you can tell that he's also pointing out the quirks, if not flaws, in the story at the same time that he is defending it. But even though it's ranked 146, the worst story of all time is 241. So that means of the bottom 95 episodes of Doctor Who of all time over the first 50 years, none of them come from the Philip Hinchcliffe era.
It's a good track record.
Amazing legacy. If you go down to the bottom of the list, just about every other producer is accounted for. Twin Dilemma, JNT, Fear Her, that is Stephen Moffat. Dominators, that was the Peter Bryant / Derek Sherwin era. Rings of Akaten, that is Stephen Moffat. The Censorites, Verity Lambert. And I would argue that the Hartnell era is probably the greatest era of the show, bar none. I hope to talk about it somewhere else someday. Even Verity Lambert has a clunker at number 225, The Censorites, one of the bottom 16. Underwater Menace, Jerry Davis and Innes Lloyd, 224. Web Planet is 219. There's another Verity Lambert. So every producer has a clunker in the bottom 25 except Philip Hinchcliffe.
I was going to say Barry Letts and Terrence Dix would have The Time Monster, which is probably my least favorite Doctor Who story, certainly of the classic era.
Time Monsters in the bottom 20, literally at number 222. And the Horns of Nymon, Graham Williams, is ranked 223. It's also in the bottom 20. I think that is a travesty and a mockery and a sham, because I love Horns of Nymon unreservedly. And it's coming up on this show soon. But at the same time, The Power of Krull is ranked at 212. That's in the bottom 30. And that certainly deserves to be in the bottom 30 for many reasons.
Yeah, I would certainly say that Horns of Nymon and Power of Krull should be the other way around. Yeah, definitely.
I would probably have Horns in my top 100 or top 75 just as comfort food alone. I really enjoy that story on many levels, and I'll explain why here, hopefully in a few more weeks. So, Daniel, we've got about 10 minutes left. We've talked about the novelization. We've talked about Philip Hinchcliffe. We've talked about the bottom 20. We've gotten in our obligatory Dominators talk today. We've talked about Chibnall and Jodie and what we're expecting on Sunday when Power of the Doctor airs. Now it is time to play a game. And you have volunteered, since you played Guess That Cliffhanger last time, you have volunteered for your first game of 20 questions.
Okay.
I have selected at random from the archives on randomizer.net one single Doctor Who story from 1963 to the present. You have 20 yes or no questions to guess what it is. The record holder for now, and hopefully for all time, is our good friend Conrad, who guessed it in 6 his last time out. Let's see, Daniel, how you do. Question number 1.
Is it in black and white?
It is not in black and white. Question 2.
Is it in the new series?
It is in the new series. Question 3.
Is it a Russell T. Davis episode?
Yes, it is a Russell T. Davis episode. Question 4.
Does it have Billy Piper in it?
Yes, it does have Billy Piper in it. Now you've gotten 3 of the first 4 questions. We're at question 5, and you are now a dark horse to win the whole shebang. Conrad, hang on to your belt. Someone's coming for you.
Is it from Series 2?
Conrad, look over your shoulder. It is from Series 2. You have one shot with question 6 at tying Conrad and grabbing the piece of the crown. Can Daniel become king of the podcast?
Well, I'll give it a shot. Is it the Idiot's Lantern?
Conrad, you're safe for one more week, my friend. It is not the Idiot's Lantern. In fact, if the Idiot's Lantern ever came up in the randomizer, I would probably turn it back and not use it on the show, because the story I never hope to talk about ever again. Question 7.
Does it have the Cybermen in it?
It does not have the Cybermen in it. Question 8.
Okay.
You've ruled out about half of Series 2 now, so you're going to get it. There are fewer stories left, and you have questions remaining. The question is, how fast can you narrow it down?
Does it have Jackie Tyler in it?
It does not have Jackie Tyler in it. Question 9.
I'm trying to think of. Is it set in modern day Earth?
It is not set in modern day Earth. Question 10. That only leaves a couple of more choices.
It does. Well, 4 I can think of. Is it Tooth and Claw?
It is not Tooth and Claw. Question 11. Since you're guaranteed to get it right, I'll just give you one hint. You're approaching the season from the wrong order.
Okay. Is it the Impossible Planet and the Satan Pit?
It is not the Impossible Planet / Satan Pit. Question 12.
Is it the Girl in the Fireplace?
It is not the Girl in the Fireplace. Question 13. I think you've got through the entire season except for one or two stories.
Is it New Earth?
It is New Earth, yes. Ding, ding, ding. See, if you had just started at the beginning of the season and worked your way down.
Just went my way through, yeah.
It's funny because one episode not too long ago, the story that I picked out of the randomizer was The Daleks, which was the second story ever. And if my guess that we could just started from the very beginning and work his way forward, he would have gotten it in 2 questions. Which, of course, I do not recommend, because there's a lot more choices than there are questions.
I was going to say, Conrad is not only breathing easily, he's going, what an idiot. 13 goes.
Conrad is way too polite to ever call anybody an idiot. But I think Conrad is glad that he is safe for, and he's very proud of that title, and I hope he keeps it for a long time. But Dale Smith nearly dethroned him. You came close to dethroning him, so it's a precarious title.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what I'm going to do now is reload the randomizer for my next victim, I mean my next guest, and we'll see who is going to get the next story. Ah, okay, that is going to be interesting. That is a story that I think is going to be problematic to guess, and I am curious to see if next week or the next time we play 20 questions, we're going to get our first person to not win, because that is going to be a tough story to guess.
Okay. Right,
Daniel, so where else can we find you on the podcasting sphere? What else have you been up to since the last time that you and I spoke on this program?
Well, I'm on Twitter at DanielKnight73, and I've got three children and quite a hectic life. We've just bought chickens, so that's another addition to the family. My wife is very pleased that she's not the only lady of the house now that we have three boys and now three chickens named Rose, Susan and Judy. Rose after Billy Piper's character, but not Susan as in the Doctor's granddaughter. It's Susan from the Narnia books. I recently did the Trap One podcast for the novelization of The Androids of Tara.
Yes, with Cy Hart.
A really good book, and really would recommend it, and really enjoyed doing that. Done a couple of hamster podcasts with Joe Ford.
I will ask, though, because you've left us in suspense.
Yeah.
You have a chicken name for Billy Piper.
Mm-hmm.
You have a chicken name for Susan, who came to a pretty sad end at the end of the last battle. You have not told us, who is Judy named for?
Ah, Judy is named after the character in Paddington, the Jonathan and Judy, the children in the Paddington stories.
Ah, yes.
Which are a big favorite in our household.
There used to be a long-running TV series in the States called Romper Room, which was basically nursery school on television. Then there was a different host in every major city, and there was a syndicated version, I think operating out of New York, if memory serves me right. And they would often show interstitials. So they showed Simon and the Land of Chalk Drawing, which is how I first became acquainted with Bernard Cribbins. Mm-hmm. And they also showed Paddington. So that's how I'm familiar with that, because they did get a good airing in the States, even though they were UK properties.
Yeah.
And, of course, Paddington has the recent series of feature films co-starring Peter Capaldi.
Peter Capaldi, Hugh Bonneville as well, who's been in Doctor Who. I think Jessica Hines is in there. Sanjeev Bhaskar, Matt Lucas. Yeah. Quite a lot of Doctor Who actors or guest actors are in the films. They're great films to watch. I think that they should get around to doing the third one fairly soon, but I think they'll have to recast Jonathan and Judy because they're probably all grown up now.
I also want to give a shout out to Michael E. Bryant, regrettably not on this show, but he is going to be featuring in a upcoming two-part podcast episode of Maximum Power. That's the Blake's 7 podcast featuring many friends of this program, Cy mm-hmm. Hart, Pete Lambert, Mark McManus. So I would love to get Michael E. Bryant on this show, but he is going to be a two-parter on Maximum Power because he was the very first director of Blake's 7. So I would definitely urge my followers to give a listen to that or anywhere else where you can find Daniel. I will be back on Trap 1 probably about within a week after you hear this. I'll be on the Trap 1 panel rounding up Power of the Doctor. And Daniel, of course, has recently been on a Trap 1 for the Android Invasion. I will be spearheading a Trap 1 for The Stones of Blood just as soon as I finish reading it. My copy finally arrived in the States a few days ago. Mm-hmm. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for giving it a good go at 20 questions. We'll get you back on here real soon now. Have a great night.
And you too. Thanks, Jason.
Doctor Who and the Robots of Death, written by Terence Dicks. televised as The Robots of Death, teleplay by Chris Boucher, televised in January and February 1977, published in May 1979. On a desert planet, the giant sand miner crawls through the howling sandstorms, harvesting the valuable minerals in the sand. Inside, the humans relax in luxury, while most of the work is done by the robots who serve them. Then the Doctor and Leela arrive, and the mysterious deaths begin. First suspects, then hunted victims, Leela and the Doctor must find the hidden killer, or join the other victims of the robots of death. It's May 1979. Between May 1976 and December 1980, only five people wrote Doctor Who novelizations. Our boy Terence, Philip Hinchcliffe, Ian Martyr, Malcolm Hulk, and Jerry Davis. And that's Davis with an asterisk. He wrote only one book during this nearly five-year stretch. Terence wrote the bulk of the books, and by the late 1970s, he was churning out literally eight books a year, adapting more books than all the other four authors combined. If you arrange the target novelizations in story order on your bookshelf, you'll notice a long run of really slim books, barely cracking 100 pages each. The Robots of Death is one of these super slim ones, one of four such volumes, all published in 1979, towards the end of the era, when Terence was pretty much Target's only game in town. This week, we're talking about the second of those four micro books. Terence's output wasn't very well remembered by adult fans by the time I reached Rekart's Doctor Who in the early 90s. These novelizations were thought to be slim and cursory, mere transcripts of camera scripts without much depth. Something rushed and unimpressive, compared to Target's lush mid-70s or late 80s output. Of course, this podcast, which is now fast approaching its first anniversary, is dedicated to the proposition. Well, there I am quoting Abraham Lincoln more so than Terence Dix, at least for the moment. Dedicated to the proposition that there's much, much more depth to even a short Terence book. As Simon Hart mentioned earlier in his correspondence piece, Terence's prose is effortlessly simple and technically flawless. You have to be highly elevated at your craft to write something which seems this simple. Now, I took plenty of swings at the novelization of The Invisible Enemy on last week's show, episode 47, so I'd rather talk to you on this day about how impressed I am with the depth that Terence is able to add to the barely 100-page novella that is The Robots of Death. His opening pan is typically crisp and moody. Quote, "Like a city on the move, the sand miner glided across the desert sands. It was about to become a ship of death." And yes, I know, it sounded better when Daniel said it earlier. Terence teaches us a few things about Leela, such as how growing up in a tribe perpetually at war made her an accomplished field medic, or how she doesn't understand the runaway capitalism of the story's unnamed planetary locale. Terence finds ways to add surprisingly lush visuals and keen character insights into what appears to be a minuscule book. For example, Terence drops several clues early on about how the humans on board the Sandminer take their robot servants for granted and lets us know how unprepared they are for the coming massacre. Quote, "With practice, the human ear could detect the minute differences between one robot voice and another, if anyone cared to take the trouble." End quote. And that's all we need to know about the book's human-robot fodder, even before the characters are properly introduced. We also get a few glimpses inside Dask's head, early enough to telegraph that he's the mastermind behind the robots, such as when he notes with satisfaction that another human being is losing to a robot at chess. Ditto the clue that Poole is an undercover detective, as Terence cites his constant watchfulness in his very first appearance. On the other hand, though, it's hard to write eight books a year and not have some of the seams showing. There are several moments of unusual sloppiness. Unusual for Terence, that is. Three straight chapter titles have the word robot in them. The Sandminer is called a massive metal crab in back-to-back chapters. and the phrase slowly forward appears twice in a 3-paragraph stretch. Cass is rather famously shown alive in the background of a scene after Leela has already discovered his corpse, and in the same scene, someone accuses Borg of knowing a secret that the commander has just announced to the entire room 4 paragraphs previously. The revelation that D-84 is a Super Vok robot in disguise, and that Poole is his human detective counterpart, is dumped by Terrence in expository prose, rather than organically worked into the dialogue. But by way of redeeming features, Terrence also gives lush descriptions of the colorful desert landscape in a way that didn't wind up evident on TV, with, quote, "the sounds of the storm winds rose like the howling of 1,000 angry demons."
Doctor, you were right, the robot's out of control.
Not anymore, we're quite safe now.
Safe, oh. Safe?
Well, we'll have to send up a satellite distress beacon to get back to base, but there's no trouble.
Ivanov, you remind me very strongly of a lady called Marie Antoinette. There's a robot revolution going on out there, and you say we've got no problems.
Doctor, every single robot has been switched off. There's not one of them working.
Ivanov! Look over there.
I don't understand.
Shut the door, Toos. I may not have time to explain. There's a new generation of killer robots about, Ivanov. The killers are controlled by Taral Capel, and D-84 is controlled by Poole. These two are undercover agents for the company.
Poole is damaged. I do not understand what has happened to him. This may be because I am not human.
Yes, that's very likely.
How did you find out about Poole?
Well, his body language was all wrong.
What's body language?
Well, it's the theory that a person expresses himself in the way he moves.
You said he was a hunter?
Yes, you did. Do you know what's wrong with Poole? Ivanov?
Yes. Robophobia.
That's right. The lawyer would call it Grimwade syndrome.
I have seen it, Doctor. Once before. My very first command. Young kid. Just ran outside the mine. I tried to save him. I couldn't. We'll never, ever forget the look on his face.
Zilda's brother.
His father, of course, had it all hushed up. He was afraid his son would be thought a coward. But robophobia is a mental thing, right?
Oh, yes, yes, it is, until one gets his hands around your neck.
Having read these books dozens of times, something else I like to look for now is the evolution of the story from script to the small screen. Remembering, as always, that Terrence was typically working from rehearsal scripts, not a videotape of the completed TV production, Tom Baker added a lot in rehearsal, or even on the studio floor. Changing lines, adding the odd Shakespeare quote, here from the Scottish play, or looking for novel ways to enter doorways or jump out in the middle of scenes. None of Tom's improvisational genius comes across in the book, or in most novelizations, because the material Terrence is working from predates that, although at least the Doctor doesn't mispronounce Terran in the book, as he did on TV. Also sadly missing from the book is D-84's Please Do Not Throw Hands at Me, an inspired bit of business worked out in rehearsal. The repeated, I heard a cry, that was me, banter between D-84 and the Doctor goes on for much longer on TV, as Tom Baker milked humor out of a seemingly dry exchange. Let's give a listen to the original.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
Terrence also describes the short-lived character, Borg, as Burly twice, even though the actor eventually cast to play Borg, Brian Croucher, looked downright Lilliputian next to Tom Baker. Terrence did know that director Michael E. Bryant went off script and cast minority actors for Zilda and Cass, and reflects that in the text of the novelization, although in 1979 he felt it acceptable to describe Zilda as a, quote, dark girl, end quote, in a way which sounds outright malicious today. But the Target books as a whole were full of things like that, which we would much rather forget. Commander Yuvanov, in the book, is a bit of an idiot, literally described as, quote, something pathetic, end quote, with Terrence hammering home his ineptness at multiple turns. Quote, Yuvanov gave the body a last, disgusted look, as though it had died just to annoy him, which stacks up oddly against the TV story, where Russell Hunter, playing against type, made Yuvanov an authoritative, sinister, but ultimately heroic figure. Terrence also misses the depths that Pamela Salem would bring to the role of Tooze. Compare how limp her dialogue looks on the page versus how Salem delivered them on TV. As always, I love Terrence's wry asides, the way he comments on the action. You can tell whether or not he liked a story based on the nature of his asides. All motive units are closing down, said V-16, reporting success in exactly the same tones it had used for Disaster. At the end, Dask, the human killer, and wannabe robot, is torturing the Doctor. Terrence slips into the Doctor's thoughts and tells us that the Doctor feels, quote, genuine pity for the killer. Terrence clearly enjoyed the story a lot more than the previous Invisible Enemy. He might not have had much more than a week or two to write the teeny manuscript, but he certainly imbues it with as much care as the situation allowed. Had he been given 20 more pages to work with, as he would have both before and after this stretch of minuscule books, the Robots of Death novelization might be remembered with far more acclaim. Next time, on Doctor Who Literature, we jump ahead another 2 months to July 1979. Terrence is back with the third of his four micro-novels of 1979. With the Hinchcliffe era closed for good in the books, we dip back into the Graham Williams era for the third time. After the delight of Horror of Fang Rock and the travesty of The Invisible Enemy, we land firmly in the middle of those two stories, in terms of quality, with a Chris Boucher curiosity, and shades of how three straight novelizations of Bob Baker and Dave Martin stories came out in a row earlier in 79. This is the second straight novelization of a Chris Boucher TV story. Do you ever feel as if your timelines are being manipulated by these odd patterns of Target books coming out? Have you been used? Have I been used? Has mankind been used? Join me and my sometime podcast producer next week as we team up to ponder the infinite mysteries of Doctor Who and the image of the Fendal. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. I'm Jason, your host and editor and producer. Special thanks to my special guest, Daniel Knight. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at anchor.fm/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and under the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. Although as my pilgrimage ends later today with the release of The Power of the Doctor, that hashtag might be retiring very soon. And of course, you can also reach me on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Direction Point! Direction Point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.